This is Audible.
Recorded Books presents an unabridged recording of Gap Creek by Robert Morgan, narrated by Kate Forbes, and including an interview with the author. This work is copyrighted 1999 by Robert Morgan. This recording is copyrighted 2000 by Recorded Books. While Gap Creek was in production at the studios of Recorded Books, Robert Morgan came to visit, giving us a chance to talk with him a while about the writing of the book. You'll find that interview at the end of the recording. A native of the North Carolina mountains, he was raised on land settled by his Welsh ancestors. In Julie Harmon, he has created a memorable character, a mountain woman who, folks say, works hard as a man, so hard that sometimes she's not sure she can stop. But for Julie Harmon, that's what's required. For in the Appalachian high country, in the last years of the 19th century, you can only scratch out a living, always at risk of losing it all. In the end, only love has the power to keep chaos and madness at bay. And now, Gap Creek.
Chapter 1. I know about my senior because I was there. I seen him die. We didn't tell anybody the truth because it seemed so shameful. The way he died, it was too awful to describe to other people. But I was there, even though I didn't want to be, and I seen it all. My senior was my little brother, my only brother, and us girls had spoiled him. If my senior woke up in the middle of the night and wanted some hot cornbread, one of us would get up and bake it. If my senior wanted a pretty in the store in town, we'd carry a chicken down to one of the big houses in Flat Rock and sell it to buy him the pretty. My senior got an egg every morning while the rest of us just had grits. If he wanted biscuits and molasses, Mama or one of us girls would bake them for him. I thought my senior was the cutest boy in the world. He had these blonde curls that stood out all around his head, and his eyes was blue as the mountains in the far distance. He loved to sing, and sometimes Papa would pick the banjo by the fire at night, and us girls would sing ballads like In the Shadow of the Pines, or The Two Sisters, and my senior would clap and sing along. We didn't have music that often, and it was a special treat when Papa got down the banjo. Now, the year I'm talking about was the year after Cold Friday, that day when the sun never did come out and it never warmed up. Cold Friday was the coldest day anybody had ever seen. It seemed like the end of the world when the chickens never left the roost, and it put such a chill on everything, we'll never forget that day. Papa took his coughing sickness then, and it seemed like he never was well after that. But it was the year after Cold Friday when my senior started acting poorly. My senior had always been such a healthy boy, even a little plump, from all the biscuits and molasses, and his cheeks was pink as wild roses. He had a pile of white sand out beside the house Papa had carried in the wagon from the creek. My senior made roads and castles and all kinds of mountains and valleys in the sand. He even made him a church out of sticks and set it on a hill of sand, and he stuck little rocks around it to look like a graveyard. You might have knowed a boy that done that was marked in some way. Along in the winter, my senior started to look peaked. He fell off a lot, and Mama thought it was because the cow was dry. So we borrowed milk from the millers that lived further out the ridge. But the milk didn't seem to help my senior. He got paler, and he lost his baby fat. "What that boy needs is a tonic," Cora Miller said, and she mixed up a tincture of herbs and roots that she kept in a cupboard in her kitchen with corn liquor. Mama gave my senior a tablespoon of the tonic before every meal. The tonic would bring the glow back to his cheeks for a while. We thought he was getting better. And for Christmas, he got 4 oranges and a poke of peppermint candy. But it was the day after Christmas when he woke up with the pains. My sister Rosie heard him holler out, and she went to his bed in the attic. "My belly hurts," he said. "Have you got the colic?" Rosie said. "Hurts bad," my senior said. "Everybody knows what you take for the colic is pennyroyal tea. and Mama boiled some as soon as the stove was hot, even before she cooked any breakfast. My senior sipped the tea, and it seemed to make him feel better, maybe because Mama put a little paregoric in the tea, the way you do for babies with a colic. Papa said, "Too much store-bought candy will always give a body colic." But after that, my senior got the colic even when he didn't have any store-bought candy. After the Christmas candy was long gone, he still had the terrible cramps and would wake up in the middle of the night crying. Mama would hold him in her lap and rock him by the fire, and Papa or one of us girls would hold him while Mama made pennyroyal tea. Then after he'd drunk the tea with some paregoric, he would feel better and might even sleep a little. That was a bad winter, not only because it was colder than usual, but because of the ice storms and the snows. It looked like the woods had been chopped down, there were so many trees broke by the ice. Sleet is hardest on pine trees because so much ice gathers on their needles. I doubt if there was a pine tree standing whole on the mountain. And when it snowed, it was a heavy wet snow that broke down more trees and made barns and sheds and even houses cave in. The church house at Poplar Springs fell down. Because Papa had the cough, my sister Lou and me did the heavy work outside. We got in eggs and fed the stock and carried in wood and water from the spring. I hated how everybody expected me to do the outside work. If there was a heavy job, it just fell naturally to me, and sometimes Lou, like it always had. The weather was bad so long we nearly run out of firewood. I took the axe into the woods and chopped up a blow-down tree. And then I hitched up the horse Sally to the sled and drug in a load. My hands like to froze, it was so wet and cold. "Julie can work like a man," Mama said when I brought the load of wood into the front room. "Somebody's got to work like a man," I said, and dropped the logs on the edge of the hearth. My hands got rough from the cold and the hard work. I rubbed grease on them at night to soften the calluses and moisten the dry skin. I would have liked to have kept my hands soft the way Rosie did hers. During the terrible winter when Papa took the chest consumption, we didn't hardly get off the mountain, and we almost run out of cornmeal. If Papa did the least little thing, he would start coughing and get so weak he couldn't hardly sit up. He'd always been such a strong man before that it embarrassed him to be so helpless. Mama liked to say, "Now you can do without a lot of things, but a family can't do without cornmeal. If you run out of meal, you don't have any bread and you don't have any mush, and you don't have anything to fry fish in or squirrels. When the meat runs out and the taters run out, the only thing that will keep you going is the cornbread. You can live a long time on bread and collard greens if you have collard greens, and you can live a long time on bread alone if you have to, in spite of what the Bible says." We got down to the last peck of cornmeal in the bin, and then to the last gallon. Mama started skimping on the size of the corn pone she baked every morning. "My senior won't get better if he don't have plenty to eat," Mama said, "and your papa won't either." "Maybe we'll freeze to death before we starve," I said. "Don't talk that way," Mama said. "You take some corn down to the mill." There was still ice on the trees and snow on the ground, but I seen what I was going to have to do. I resented it, but I seen what had to be done. The road was too slick and steep for either the wagon or the sled. I couldn't carry enough corn on my back down the mountain and back up. Even if my sister Lou went with me, we couldn't carry enough between us. Lou was the toughest of my sisters. She was almost as strong as me. I saw that the only way to take a bushel of corn to mill was to sling it over the horse's back and lead her down the mountain. It would take both me and Lou to lead Sally. "Lou, you're going to have to help me," I said. "Why ain't I surprised?" Lou said. Took us all day to get down the mountain, wait for the turn of corn to be ground while the men eyed us and told jokes, and then lead Sally back up the trail. We got home a little after dark, and the sacks was damp. but we had enough fresh meal to last a few weeks until the weather opened up, and Papa was well enough to drive the wagon down the mountain. But even with plenty of cornbread and milk to eat, my senior didn't get any better. He kept falling off no matter how much he ate. And then he started to get a fever and the night sweats. He had terrible dreams that would make him holler out in the night. He yelled one time, "There is snakes dancing." And when we woke him up, he said there was a pit where snakes was swaying to music. He looked scared out of himself. He was so scared by his dream, he dreaded to go back to sleep. One of us had to set up with him after he drunk his tea with paregoric. There were some long nights that winter on into February and early March. But it was after the weather broke, after it looked like things was opening up and Papa's cough was a little better, that my senior took the terrible fever. One morning Mama felt him and he was hot as a coal, and all day he just got hotter. By evening he was talking out of his head. "Mama, why don't you have Gabriel come blow his horn?" he said. We knowed he was a little beside himself. Mama had read him a story from the Bible the night before. After it got dark, he just growed hotter. When a person has a bad fever, they just seem to glow. My senior was so lit up with the heat, he looked swelled enough to bust. "What can we do to bring his fever down?" Papa said. "We can rub him in alcohol," Mama said. We stripped the clothes off my senior and rubbed him all over with alcohol. The room was filled with fumes, and you would have thought it would freeze him to death. But after all that sponging, he was hot as ever. "I've heard you're supposed to wrap up a body that has the fever," Lou said. "He's been wrapped up all day," Rosie said. "There's nothing else to do but bathe him in cold water," Papa said. I went down to the spring and got a bucket of fresh water. It was a cool night with a full moon, and the water was near freezing. "This is liable to give him pneumonia," I said. "If we can't bring it down, the fever'll cook his brain," Mama said. Now, I've heard that somebody in a high fever sees visions and speaks wisdom. I've heard you're supposed to gather round a fever patient to hear a message from heaven. But while we peeled my senior's clothes off and bathed him in cold water, he didn't say a thing that made sense. When we put him in the tub of cold water, he screamed, "It's the haints with no eyes!" That's all he talked about, haints with no eyes. "There's no haints," Mama said to him. "There's nothing here but us." But it didn't do no good. He kept his eyes wide open and jabbered on about what he could see. It scares you when a fever keeps going up. It's like watching somebody slide toward a brink and you can't stop them. My senior was so hot it burned your hand to touch him. "We've got to make him sweat," Mama said. "How do you make him sweat?" Papa said. "By wrapping him in quilts and putting pans of hot water under his bed," Mama said. "Well, that'll just make him hotter," Papa said. "Sweating's the only thing that'll cool him off," Mama said. We got nigh every blanket in the house and piled them on my senior. And we heated kettles of water on the stove and in the fireplace and poured boiling water in pans, which we slid under the bed. It got so hot in the house we was all sweating. I lifted the covers and looked at my senior. It was like his skin had closed tight, and he couldn't sweat. "He's going to die if we don't do something," Papa said. "What else can we do?" Mama said. "We can make him drink hot lemon tea," Papa said. Rosie and me squeezed some lemon juice into hot water, and they tried to make my senior drink a cup of that. But he wouldn't wake up enough to drink anything. His eyes was closed, and he wouldn't rouse. "Drink some of this, darling," Mama said and patted his cheek. "Maybe he should drink something cold," Papa said. "I don't think he can drink anything," Mama said. She held the cup to my senior's mouth, but his lips was closed. "If we was to pour it down his throat, he might strangle," Papa said. It got to be midnight, and Papa wound up the clock on the mantel. As he turned the key, he looked at my senior, and you could tell how worried he was. Papa was still weak himself from the lung sickness. "I'll carry him to the doctor," Papa said. "You can't carry him to the doctor in the middle of the night," Mama said. "I'll carry him down the mountain, and Julie can hold the lantern," Papa said. Papa always did depend on me when he needed something. If there was a hard job to be done, it just had to be me that done it. I didn't know but what my senior had a catching sickness. I was near about afraid to touch him. "Why does it have to be me?" I said. "Because you're the strongest one in the family," Mama said, "and because everybody has to do what they can." Mama always did know how to make me ashamed when I tried to get out of a job. "All right, I'll do it," I said, as I always did when they expected me to do something they didn't want to do. It was a cold, clear night, with the moon shining, when we started out. We didn't even need the kerosene lantern in open places, but I lit the wick anyway and carried it like a pail of light down the path in front of Papa. He toted my senior on his right shoulder, wrapped in a blanket. Sometimes my senior groaned, but he was so asleep he didn't know what was happening. When we got to the woods, we needed the lantern, and in the hollers where the moon didn't reach, it was black as a Bible. The woods smelled different at night, and I kept thinking as we picked our way down the trail how I could smell rotten leaves and water in the branch. And I thought how it was almost time to find sprouted chestnuts where they fell in the fall and got covered with leaves and was beginning to sprout now. Nothing is sweeter than a sprouted chestnut. It cheered me up a little to think of chestnuts. I heard a dog bark somewhere off in the woods near the Jeter place. And then something up in the mountains squalled, like a person in terrible pain. "What is that?" I said. "Nothing but a wildcat," Papa said. The scream come again, this time closer. "Must be following us," I said. "Just a wildcat," Papa said, and I could tell from his voice he was nigh out of breath. "Here, I'll carry my senior," I said. "You carry the lantern," Papa said. "I'm all right." But Papa was winded. He was ashamed to admit it, but he was winded. "Won't do my senior no good if you get wore out," I said. "I can carry him," Papa said. He kept walking a little further, too stubborn to admit he was tired, and then he had to stop to catch his breath. "Here, let me take him," I said. I set the lantern down on the trail and turned and took my senior from Papa. Papa was so weak his arms trembled when he handed the boy to me. My senior didn't feel all that heavy, except he was limp as a sack of flour. I was afraid to touch him, but didn't have any choice. I slung him up against my shoulder and followed Papa down the trail. It took us over an hour to make it down the mountain. Dr. Prince lived in one of the big houses down in Flat Rock. He was the son of the old Judge Prince that had founded Flat Rock, and he lived part of the year in Charleston and part in the mountains. And when he was in Flat Rock, he doctored the mountain folks, same as the Flat Rock people. Sometimes he rode his horse with a doctor bag slung behind the saddle out on the ridges and to the far coves beyond Pinnacle. I knowed the doctor had a big cur dog that he kept in a fence in front of his house. Everybody had seen the cur dog. I didn't know what we would do when we got close to the house, for the dog was supposed to be mean. Though my senior had not felt heavy when I took him on my shoulder, his little body got weightier and weightier as I stumbled down the trail. It was like somebody was adding pounds to him the further we went. I stiffened my back and locked my arm around him and followed Papa swinging the lantern. I was still mad that I had to carry him, and that gave me more strength. When we come out of the woods into the open country around Flat Rock, the moonlight was so bright it seemed like day. I could almost see the green and the grass along the creek, and the windows of houses made you think there was lights inside them. Dew on the fields sparkled like beads. I was so tired my arms ached, and my legs trembled by the time we got to the gate of Dr. Prince's house. Sure enough, the dog set up a growl and a bark. He come running from the porch and stood behind the gate, snarling. He would have ate up anybody that come through that gate. "You holler for the doctor," Papa said. "Let me catch my breath," I said, and shifted my senior to my left shoulder and called out, "Dr. Prince!" The dog set up an even bigger fuss, and I heard a noise in the house. "Hey, Dr. Prince!" I shouted. A light was lit somewhere inside the house, and a door opened. "Who is there?" a voice called. "This is Julie Harmon and her papa. My senior is bad sick." "Is he with you?" the voice called. "We carried him down the mountain," I said. The doctor called the dog back and held him on the porch while we climbed the steps and went inside. The cur growled as we passed him. It was a big fancy house with high ceilings and lots of mirrors and lamps. The doctor led us into his study, which was lined with books. Rich folks' houses always smell like toilet water and some kind of soap. We laid my senior on the table in the middle of the room, and Dr. Prince brought a bright lamp over and looked at him. Dr. Prince had a big mustache like the German Bismarck. He pulled the blanket back and felt of my senior's pulse. "How long has he had the fever?" he said. "He got hot 2 nights ago," Papa said. Dr. Prince bent down and sniffed my senior's breath and listened to his heart. "Could he have milk sick?" the doctor said. "Too early for milk sick," Papa said. "Then it must be typhoid," the doctor said. I was going to say hadn't nobody else on the mountain had typhoid, but I didn't. Who was I to argue with Dr. Prince? Dr. Prince went to a shelf and got a bottle of something that looked like reddish syrup. "Let's give him a dram of this," he said. I had to hold my senior's head up, and Papa pried his mouth open with his fingers. But I don't think my senior knowed what was happening when the doctor poured the spoon of syrup in his mouth. Some dribbled out the corners of his mouth, but I guess a little went down his throat. My senior was too deep asleep to know the difference. "You'll have to watch him closely," the doctor said and handed Papa the bottle of syrup. "Every fever is different." "I'm afraid I don't have no money," Papa said. "You can pay me later," Dr. Prince said. It was the way the doctor said it so quick that told us he was rich and didn't need our money. "I'll bring you a dollar soon as I sell some chickens," Papa said. "That will be fine," Dr. Prince said. He showed us to the door and held the big cur dog by the collar while we walked to the gate. I never did see any of the doctor's servants. I know Papa was tired before we even started back up the mountain. I was wore out myself in my legs and in my back, and my arms was sore. We had 4 miles to walk still, and they was up the mountain. "Let me carry my senior," I said. "We'll take turns," Papa said. "I should carry him now on the flat ground," I said, "and you can carry him when the trail gets steep." "We'll both get wore out," Papa said. "I can rest while you're carrying him," I said. I took my senior from Papa. The boy was dead asleep. His head laid on my shoulder. I prayed, "Lord, let us get my senior home. Don't let him die out here on the trail in the damp night air." I had never prayed with such a will. It was the prettiest night you ever saw, with the moonlight slanting on the creek and dew sparkling in the grass. The mountains rose like shadows ahead of us. It must have been 3 o'clock in the morning, and the mountains were so still and peaceful you would have thought the millennium had come and all our trials was over. It was the first time I ever noticed how the way the world looks don't have a thing to do with what's going on with people. I locked my arm around my senior like I never meant to let go, and I stomped the ground hard to make my steps firm. If I had to carry him all the way up the mountain, I could. I was determined to get this over and done with. There was strength in me I had never called on, and this might be the time I had to use it. Papa lit the lantern when we got to the woods and started climbing. It was so still, I could hear our breath and the flutter of flame in the lantern. Sometimes a twig or an acorn dripped off the trees. I'd never seen the woods that quiet. There wasn't even a dog barking anywhere, and the wildcat must have found its mate, for I didn't hear any more squalling. When you make extra effort, a numbness sets in, like your legs are walking on their own and you're not willing them to. But as I kept going, a throbbing started in my back, and every step hurt, like I had cramps in my back and arms. "Want me to take him?" Papa said, after we had gone maybe a mile. "I'll take him a little further," I said. I figured if I could get to the bench on the mountain where Riley Spring was, we could rest and give my senior a drink of cold water. Then Papa and me could take turns carrying him the rest of the way up the mountain. "You are going the extra mile," Papa said. The extra 4 miles, I thought, but didn't say it. When you are straining, you have a short temper and a sharp tongue. Mama liked to say, "It weakens you to feel proud of yourself." Better use your breath to fight against the trail, to fight against the mountain, I told myself. We had got a little further up the trail, up to where the beds of moss growed below the laurel thicket, when I felt my senior stiffen in my arms. I thought he must be waking up and stretching, that the syrup the doctor had give him was having a good effect. But his back arched too stiff and fast. "Are you awake, little feller?" I said. I started to pat his back, but felt his whole body stirring. "Is he awake?" Papa said. "Must be," I said, for my senior was twisting in my arms like a baby that will jump even while you're holding it. But there was something wrong, because the stirring continued and his back kept jerking. "Hold the light here," I said to Papa. Papa brought the lantern up close, and the first thing I saw was my senior's face. His eyes was open like he had seen something terrible, and his mouth was drawn back in a scream, but no sound come out except the gnashing of his teeth. He looked like he had seen the awfulest thing, and it had scared him to death. "Is he dying?" I said. "He's having a fit," Papa said. My senior's feet was kicking now, and his whole body heaving. I didn't know what to do. Should I lay him down, or hurry on up the trail toward home? Should we turn and go back down the trail to the doctor's house? "Put him down here," Papa said, and held the lantern over a bank of moss beside the trail. I knelt down and laid my senior on the ground, and it was the worst sight to see him twist and kick with both legs. I've never seen anybody have fits before. "What can we do?" I said, and held his head off the cold moss. I felt helpless. It was like the night was crushing down on top of me. "Put something between his teeth," Papa said, "so he won't swallow his tongue." All I had to put between my senior's teeth was a corner of the blanket we had wrapped him in. I folded it twice and stuck it in his mouth, which was foaming with spit. His head jerked as I pushed the fabric between his teeth. And then he coughed and coughed again. I seen he was choking. I wondered if he had swallowed his tongue or was he choking on his own spit. I stuck my finger in his throat to pull out the block and felt something rush up into his mouth. "He's strangling," I screamed. Papa held the lantern closer, and we seen that my senior was throwing up. White stuff come out of his mouth, and lines of white stuff. "My God," I said. For I thought he was throwing up milk or some white gravy. But what come out of his mouth was gobs of squirming things. They was worms, wads and wads of white worms. He kept coughing and throwing up, and more come out. "He's choking," Papa said, and reached his hand into my senior's mouth and pulled out more gobs of the things. I shuddered, looking at what he was doing. Papa dug out more worms to clear my senior's mouth and throat, and when he stopped, my senior's mouth was open and his eyes was open, but he was still. "Make him breathe," I cried, and shook my senior's chest. Papa pushed on my senior's heart and listened to his chest. "He's not breathing," he said. My senior's mouth was open, and his eyes was open in the lantern light. "What can we do?" I said. We just looked at his little body, and I couldn't think of anything else to do. Something twitched in a nostril. It was another worm that had found its way out through his nose. I sat there on the cold ground, feeling that human life didn't mean a thing in this world. People could be born, and they could suffer, and they could die, and it didn't mean a thing. The moon was shining above the trees, and the woods was peaceful. I could hear the creek down the ridge, gentle as a dove, and the mountains was still as ever. The ground under me was solid, but little my senior was dead. There was nothing we could do about it, and nothing cared except Papa and me. The world was exactly like it had been and would always be, going on about its business. We must have sat on the ground several minutes before we got the strength to pick up my senior and carry him up the trail. Papa and me took turns toting the body, and we got to the house in the first light of day. Mama and Rosie was waiting up, with the lamp still burning on the mantel. Chapter 2. After my senior died, there was just us four girls in the family, Lou and me and Rosie, and Carolyn the youngest. Rosie was the oldest, and Lou was next. After we lost my senior, Carolyn got spoiled almost as bad as he had and never did a bit of work around the place. It was like we had to spoil somebody, and with no brother it was just natural that Carolyn would be the one. Mama made Carolyn pretty pink dresses with lace and ribbons on them, and she fixed Carolyn's hair in ringlet curls and a pink bow. Carolyn looked more like a doll than a regular child. Papa's lungs had started to get a little weaker. When he got overworked or soaked in a storm or chilled by a draft in church, it would take him in the chest. He'd get his feet wet mowing along the branch, and before midnight he'd be coughing and spitting into the fireplace. He had been a strong man, but the chest consumption weakened him all over. When his lungs hurt, he couldn't sleep, and when he coughed, none of us could sleep much either. The rest of us, except Carolyn, sure worked plenty. As Mama got older, she sometimes had back trouble and couldn't stand up straight and had to walk bent over. It might have been rheumatism or something inside her way down, but it throwed more work on us girls when she was poorly. Rosie didn't mind doing her share of the housework. She never did like to work outside in the yard and fields, but she would cook things. She liked to sew and to knit. She could do embroidery and knit socks and sweaters and shawls, and she liked crocheting counterpanes and fancy pieces. Rosie would help to dust and clean up, but she preferred to be in the kitchen or setting by the fire with her yarn and hook with a cat in her lap. That needle pulled and pulled and pulled, looping the soft knots of the vest or throw she was crocheting. Her bag of thread and needles, scissors and extra hooks, set on the floor beside her chair. But what Rosie liked most of all was cooking. She always kept a fire in the cook stove and a pot of coffee warm on the top of the stove. Rosie would sip coffee while she was rolling out dough for a pie crust or cooking down strawberries for preserves. She had her own box of spices and seasonings on the shelf, and she didn't want anybody else to touch them. She dried herbs from the little garden on the bank and put the leaves in bottles and jars like a druggist might. "I don't want anybody to touch my herbs," she said. "They might mix them up." "How do you know they're not already mixed up?" Lou said once. "I know by the look and the smell," Rosie said. She took the cap off a bottle and sniffed it. Lou was the only one of my sisters that was willing to work outside. I don't think she liked it, but she was willing to help out. Like I said, when Papa got sick, it fell on me to take care of the stock and field crops. But Lou would pitch in and help. Biggest job the year round was to bring in wood, for we had to have fuel for the cook stove and the fireplace. We had to keep the house warm when Papa was coughing, and that meant load after load of wood. Ever since I was a girl, I had worked with Papa to cut firewood. I could pull a cross-cut saw and chop with an axe. Since I was a barefoot girl, I had been splitting kindling for Mama. But I was never good at splitting bigger chunks and logs. I had trouble lifting the sledgehammer, and I always did hate the harsh sound of steel on steel driving a wedge. But helping is one thing, and having to do it all yourself is another. Once Papa started taking to bed for long spells with his breath too short to get any air, Mama said somebody had to bring in the wagon loads and sled loads of wood, had to cut and saw and split and tote it to the porch where Mama or Rosie or even little Carolyn could reach it. Though Carolyn rarely touched anything as rough and heavy as wood. The job just fell to me without anybody explaining why. And since it had to be done, I done it and kept on doing it. For 5 Wednesdays in a row that winter, it snowed. And between the snows, it would sleet. And after every sleet come a thaw, where everything started melting. Then when it turned cold again, the water froze, so there was layers of ice and snow like a fancy cake stacked in the woods. The snow got so hard and slick, the horse couldn't hardly walk on it. That was the month our cow slid off the pasture hill into the branch and lost her calf. The ground was slicker than a pane of glass. "I don't think the horse can stand up, much less pull the sled," Lou said. "Then we'll have to pull it ourselves," I said. "I've heard of working like a dog, but never like a horse," Lou said. There wasn't no other way to bring in the load of wood that I could see, except to pull the sled ourselves. We toted the axe and saw into the woods across the pasture where a bunch of trees had been knocked down by the ice. I broke a sheath of ice off a log before we begun sawing. It was like everything had been painted an inch thick with ice and then coated again. The first thing you have to learn about a cross-cut saw is to just pull it. You don't ever push it. The other person pulls it toward them, and then you pull it back. If you try to push the saw, it will buckle and wear you out before you get started. Papa had taught me that. But Lou had never done much sawing before. Every time she pulled the handle to her, she tried to push it back. The saw pinched and stuck in the log and made it twice as hard for me to pull. "No, no, just let it go," I said. "I'm trying to help you," Lou said. The log was froze and hard to saw anyway. Fresh wood has a lot of water in it, and froze wood saws like a rock. And when Lou pushed on the saw, it was almost impossible to pull it to me. "Don't try to help me, just help yourself," I said. For a few strokes, everything went smooth, and then Lou started pushing the saw back without thinking. "Don't push," I hollered. After you have held a cross-cut saw for half an hour, your hands get so stiff you can't open the fingers. Your fingers are curled around the handle and it hurts to let go. Your fingers ache when you straighten them. We cut through the log 3 times in 20-inch pieces. My back got stiff and my fingers hurt. "Let's rest a little," I said. "We'll get cold if we stop," Lou said. I'm burning up, I said. Sweat was running down my back and around my temples, though it was below freezing in the woods. I hope no man ever sees us working like this, I said. Lou pulled the saw back to her and gasped, Why not? Because he would never think of us as ladies, I said. We're not ladies, Lou said. I don't want to be looked on like a field hand, I said. Maybe that's what some man would want, Lou said. Not any man I would want, I said. Now look who's being choosy, Lou said. We stopped to rest when the log was sawed through. I stood up and put my hands on my hips. Any man that just wanted a woman who could cook and bring in firewood would either be a cripple or too old to be any count, I said. When is a man too old to be any count? Lou said. I don't know exactly, I said, but when a man gets beyond a certain age, he's no account for a woman. And how would you know before you married him? Lou said. You'd just have to be smart, I said. As I rested, I could feel the cold sinking in. Or you could try him out, Lou said. Lou, I said. Lou always did like to say the worst thing she could think of. That would be better than marrying somebody who was no account, Lou said. When I let go of the saw handle, my hands was numb at first. But as I straightened the fingers and stretched them, they hurt like the bones had been bruised. I knowed marrying was on Lou's mind. She was 2 years older than me, and she had been thinking of getting married since she started walking home from church with Garland Hughes the year before. She was sweeter than a pound cake on Garland, and they went riding in his daddy's buggy several times, until she heard he had a girlfriend over at Pleasant Hill that he sometimes went to see, and who was going to have a baby. After that, she wouldn't walk home with him no more. But the way she grumbled and took on, you could tell she was still studying about him. She was mad at Garland, but she hadn't got over him, not by a long rifle shot. I might have been as crazy to think about boys and marriage as Lou was if I hadn't had to work so hard. There didn't seem to be any end to what I had to do to help Papa. Papa said he didn't know what he would do without me. Whatever man marries you will be the lucky one, Papa said to me, for you're the best of my girls, the best one. Well, that gave me a little chill of satisfaction that Papa would say that to me, for he wasn't a flattering man, especially with his daughters. But I thought he wouldn't talk so agreeable if a man actually asked for my hand. For what would he do without me to help him on the place? What would he do with nobody to bring in wood or hoe the corn? I could hitch up the horse as good as Papa, and I could pull fodder and cut tops off corn. I even helped him butcher hogs, though he usually got another man to help him hoist the hog once it was scraped, and slide the gambrel stick up a pole so it hung high enough to be gutted and dressed. And because I was so busy, boys hadn't paid much attention to me. A girl knows how to invite attention. But I'd never had the time to prettify myself and primp, and to study how to be at the right place to get a man's notice. Oh, I had thought about it, as any healthy girl would, and I was pleased just to see a good-looking boy at church or in town. And sometimes it gave me a thrill just to think of a good-looking boy. When I thought of a boy, I always thought of somebody I could give in to. Not one of those nervous boys that couldn't hardly look at you without blinking. I thought of a strong man that knowed what he wanted and could teach you. I wanted a body that was meant to go somewhere. I guess I wanted a man instead of a boy. But what was the good of thinking about boys when Papa needed me to help him, and my hands was so rough from holding an axe or shovel or hoe handle, I didn't want any boy to see them, much less hold them and feel the calluses and swelled knuckles. Hard work will make the joints in your hands swell up so your fingers lose their pretty shape. I didn't know if my hands would ever get soft again. They hadn't been delicate since I was a little girl, since before I started working with Papa, sawing and digging ditches with a pick and a shovel. When Lou and me had sawed 10 lengths of wood, we loaded them on the sled. It was hard to roll the heavy pieces without slipping, but at least they rolled easier on the ice than they would have in leaves. You always load wood on a sled lengthwise, for the stakes on the side keep it from rolling off. The 10 sticks was heavy, and I had my doubts whether Lou and me could pull the sled. But it was good to take a break from sawing. We picked up the ropes tied to the rings of the runners. "I never thought I would have to be an ox," Lou said. "At least not this way." I snickered, but I was already pulling too hard to laugh. The runners had stuck in the ice, and first we had to break them loose. The sourwood runners appeared to sink down in the ice a little. I pulled on one rope, and Lou pulled on the other, but we couldn't budge the sled. Twice I slipped on the ice and hit my knees. "It's too heavy," Lou said. I saw that if we had to take off some wood and pull half a load, it was hardly worth the trip. "Let's pull sideways," I said. We jerked the ropes to the left, but still the sled wouldn't loosen. I was confounded to know what to do. And then I seen a pole leaning on a downed oak tree. I took the pole and pried it under a runner of the sled. "Now pull," I hollered to Lou. She gave a yank, and the sled runners broke free. I dropped the pole and grabbed one of the ropes, and we started dragging the load through the woods. We had to lean ahead almost until our knees touched the snow. But the sled moved forward, and we kept going toward the house. In a house full of girls, there is always disagreement about the work, about who is to do what. When Papa was too sick to do anything outside, it seemed natural they expected me to look after the stock and do the milking, as well as bring in firewood. But when Papa took bad sick and didn't get any better, somebody had to nurse him too, 'cause Mama couldn't do it all. And there was things my sisters didn't like to do that had to be done, like lifting him onto the chamber pot and bathing him once a week and rolling him over when the bedclothes had to be changed. Of course, they wanted me to do it, for who wants to watch their own papa dookie in the pot, or who wants to wash him all over with a wash rag? But somebody had to, and somebody had to help Mama, and somebody had to stay up at night. And Mama had back trouble herself that winter and was too sore to do much lifting or bending over. So it fell on me a lot to stay up with Papa when his lungs got so bad he couldn't breathe at night. After I'd worked all day in the fields, I'd get a little sleep between maybe 8 o'clock and midnight, either in bed or sometimes just dozing by the fire in a chair. Then I'd rouse myself to stay up with Papa after all the others had gone to sleep. A body can do with a lot less sleep than you might think. One of the others sometimes stayed up for a while or got up at some point in the night, but it fell to me to be there for the longest time, on watch, so to speak. So I kept the lamp burning in the tiny hours as Papa struggled. It was an awful thing to see and listen to, a grown man trying to get his breath like a child with the croup. I think that's one reason why the others wanted to get away from him. By late March, Papa couldn't halfway take in any air. He rasped and panted in his throat and coughed like he didn't have the breath to cough and was going to break open. His face turned red and splotched like people with the hectic do. The night I'm talking about was windy and late in March. It had rained during the day and then turned off cold. The sarvices and the red buds was already blooming, but I guess some of their blossoms got blowed away. It was so windy, air pushed down the chimney and made the fire flutter and smoke a little. I don't think the wood smoke helped Papa breathe no better. You could hear wind roaring on the mountain like 1,000 waterfalls. Everybody else had gone to bed, and every time a gust shook the house, the windows rattled. "Papa, would you like me to heat up some water so you can breathe the steam?" I said.
"Won't do no good,"
Papa gasped. He had spit up blood earlier, and there was a blood stain in the corner of his mouth. "Want me to heat some rocks and put them under the bed?" I said. He shook his head. It was like after the long struggle all winter to throw off the weakness in his chest, he had just given up. Wind hit the house like the breath had been knocked out of somebody, and I heard something fall in the attic. It was dark except for the lamp on the table by the bed. Papa coughed so hard it looked like his eyes was going to pop out. A cough raised his back up and run through his body in waves. As he tried to cough, he stared straight up like he was looking 100 miles away. "Would you like some syrup?" I said. "Mama has made some soothing syrup out of honey and liquor with a little paregoric in it." Papa shook his head, but I got the bottle anyway and poured a tablespoon for him. "No use," he gasped. "You got to quit coughing," I said. "You're going to choke." I held the spoon to his lip and tipped some into his mouth. But he coughed, and the syrup flew back out. I tried again, but he coughed that out, too. The thing about somebody with chest sickness is they don't have any lung left to breathe with. Their chest is so ate up there's nothing to take in and hold air. And the lungs think if they cough, they can get rid of the congestion and take in more air. But the coughing don't do no good, and more coughing just makes it worse. Now I was getting scared. The light of the lamp was glaring, and everything looked sharp, just like itself, and more like itself than usual. I shuddered with the fear of what was happening. "What can I do?" I thought to myself. "I'm powerless to help Papa." I was scared as I bent down over Papa's bed and tried to make him drink some of the warm water with lemon juice in it. I knowed he was thirsty. He was dried out from coughing and from breathing so hard. He tried to drink, but he had to cough as soon as the liquid touched his throat. The warm water and lemon juice sprayed out on the bed. I had to wipe it off his face and the bedclothes. And then I tried again. It hurt to see him so hungry for air, and so parched for liquid, and unable to take either. I held the glass to his lip, and he coughed again, and lemonade dribbled on his chin. His lips was chapped, the way sick people's lips get. They cracked and bled when he coughed. It was hard to tell what was blood coughed up and blood from his lips. It reminded me of Massenier choking when he coughed. It made me sick to watch him. Papa had been the strongest kind of man all his life. He had been able to lift 2 200-pound bags of fertilizer when he was young. He had once lifted a loaded wagon while his brother fixed the wheel. He could carry a deer out of the woods after shooting it. Now his chest was sunk in and pitiful. His arms was wasted, though his hands were still big and rough. It broke my heart to look at him. There is a smell that lung sickness gives people. It's the smell of blood and congestion and fever. It's the smell of blood mixed with air that hangs over a bed and fills a sick room. It's the smell of old blood and blood that is fresh and already old. It's the smell of a festering wound. Papa raised off the pillow trying to get his breath. He gasped like he was trying to swallow the whole world to get some air in his mouth, since there was no room in his lungs. He was sweating with effort to suck in more air. "Lord," I said without even thinking, "please let Papa get his breath. I can't bear to watch him die." Papa gulped 2 more times, and his head fell back on the pillow, like he had got some air into his chest, like he was relaxing a little. His body settled down under the quilts like somebody getting ready to go to sleep. He had fell off so much he didn't look like a grown man in the bed. He resembled a bent old woman. "Lord, let Papa get some rest," I prayed. I never had been one to pray a lot on my own, but I found myself saying the words without even thinking. I tried to think if there was anything else I could do for Papa. Surely if I thought hard enough, I could find something helpful. All I wanted was for Papa to make it through till daylight. I know that most people die between midnight and dawn. I went to put another log on the fire, one of the logs Lou and me had cut and drug through the ice. The wood was too green to burn perfect, and that made the fire smoke a little. I had a few sticks of old pine, which I'd brought in for kindling, and I throwed them on the fire, too. When the new log caught, it popped like a cap pistol and hissed as if there was a snake in the wood. Then it popped again. And I seen this green flame rising out of the log and realized it must be fruit wood. It was a persimmon tree, not an oak, we had cut up. No wonder the wood was so hard, harder than oak. There was some blue in the flames, too, but mostly it was bright green. Now, I have never believed in ghosts and portents more than other people. I usually don't even listen when people are telling ghost stories, but Mama had told me a long time ago, and Grandma had told her, that a green fire in the fireplace means something is ending and something else is beginning. A green flame is a sign, like a green shoot in spring, or the green light that takes over the sky sometimes after a storm. I watched the green flame prance and strut and spread its wings. The fire twisted and beckoned as if it meant for me to follow. The fire spread on the wood like fingers on a keyboard. The log popped and hissed and then started to whine, and the wood begun to moan like somebody that was grieved. I listened for a little bit to the mournfulness, and then I shuddered and turned away. I didn't have time for such stuff. And that's when I knowed I couldn't stand to watch Papa die. I had been there when Massenear died, and I had seen it all because I had to, because I had to help Papa carry him down to the doctor's house, and now Papa was dying, and I was the one forced to watch him. I won't do it, I said out loud and stomped my foot on the floorboards. I guess I was as much scared as angry. I'd had to clean up Papa, and I'd had to set up with him, and I'd had to wait up with him instead of sleeping. And I had sawed down and hauled in and split the very logs that was keeping the house warm and burning the green portent. Everything that was hard fell to me, and everything nobody else wanted to do fell to me. I won't do it, I said again and stomped to the window. Wind shook the frame, and trees roared on the mountain like giant animals. What won't you do? Somebody said. It was Mama standing in the doorway, holding a lamp. I ain't gonna do this no more, I said. What do you mean? Mama said. I didn't say nothing else. I couldn't think of what I wanted to say. There wasn't no words that fit how I felt. Somebody has got to stay up with Papa, Mama said. I started to say I wouldn't watch Papa suffer no more, but I couldn't bring myself to say it. I had always done what Mama had told me to, and Papa had told me to. I had always done what was expected. I grabbed my coat from the peg by the door. Where are you going? Mama said. I'm going to split more wood, I said. In the middle of the night, Mama said. We've got plenty of wood. All the wood you have is what I brought in, I said. I couldn't say to her I would rather die myself than watch Papa die. It's too dark, Mama said, and windy. Rosie appeared in the door with a blanket wrapped around her shoulders like a shawl. Where is Julie going? She said. In the kitchen, I jerked the barn lantern from its nail and lit the wick. I made the flame high as it would go and closed the glass globe before stepping out into the wind on the back porch. I shivered as the blast hit my face and swirled up under my dress. The flame shuddered in the lantern, but didn't go out. The gust felt like lips blowing cold air all over me. The woodpile and woodshed was around the side of the house. I set the lantern down on the chips not too far from the chopping block. There was half a moon overhead and clouds churning and chasing themselves around its light. The ridges looked like black waves rearing up. From the woodpile you could see the lighted window of the front room where Papa was. I turned away from the house so I could get my night eyes. Didn't want to see what was going on there. I'd never refused what Mama had told me to do before, but I couldn't help myself this time. The lantern throwed its yellow glare over the chips on the ground. The chips appeared to be floating like some kind of foam. I thought there was one chip there for every single lick of the axe on the chopping block. The chips was different colored, maple, oak, pine, and hickory. The chips had stayed there like echoes from every chop. Lou and me had piled the sections of logs in the woodshed, and I took one out to the chopping block and set it on its end. Wind pushed into my face except when I bent over. If a log is less than 8 inches thick, you can usually split it without a wedge. I raised the axe up into the wind and swung where I thought the wood was, but the blade glanced off. The light only showed the outline of the piece of persimmon. I raised the axe again, and it sunk into the meat of the wood and wouldn't let go. Took me several yanks to pull the blade loose. "Julie!" somebody was calling in the wind. I looked around, but didn't see nobody on the porch. There was only the light in the window of the front room. I lifted the axe again and sunk it even deeper into the wood. This time the log split, the splinters tearing from each other right down the middle. It was a satisfying sound. I brought the axe down again, and with a crackle the wood separated into halves and fell apart. "Julie!" somebody called as I turned around toward the house. But there was nobody in sight. The voice seemed to come from out of the woods, or maybe up on the ridge. Maybe it was just the wind, but it sounded like somebody accusing me. I laid the two halves of the split stick aside and got another piece from the woodshed. The torn wood smelled fresh and sour. I could smell the sap on the axe blade. I set up the new log and got the wedge from the woodshed. Much as I hated to split wood, here I was doing it. I didn't know what else to do. Instead of going to the porch for the sledgehammer, I just used the back of the axe head to pound the wedge in. When the wedge was set, I brought the axe down hard, but my aim was off, and the wedge jumped out of the log to the ground. I hated the ring of steel on steel. It was a ring of pain, of bones breaking. There is a sourness of doom in the ping of steel driving steel. I was so mad I kicked at the chips before picking up the wedge again. The iron was cold as a fish. But this time, I set the wedge deeper before swinging down on it. The wood cracked, and I knocked the wedge loose and set it again. When the log fell in two, I split each half again. "I won't do it," I said under my breath, and the wind sucked my words away. When the moon went behind a cloud, I found I had got my night eyes a little. In the splash of lantern light, I could see the ground and the log I had set up. As I got into the motion of splitting, I found I could feel my way to the wedge with the back of the axe head. I hit the steel, and hit the steel, and hit it again. And the pieces of log fell apart like crackling shingles. As I worked, I missed less and less. "I won't do it," I said again. I was beginning to sweat, and my dress was sticking to my back under the coat. The wood fell apart like I knowed where to touch the nerve at its center with the blade. I aimed for the heart of a cut end and hit it. The wood cracked itself and cracked again. "Julie!" a voice called in the wind, but I ignored it. It was maybe 3 in the morning, and I had a lot of wood to split yet. After all the logs was busted open and ready to be carried in, I got a piece of pine from the woodshed to hack for kindling. It was fat, knotty pine I'd gathered on the ridge above Papa's new ground. Holding the axe close to the head, I shaved off some splinters from the brittle piece and then split it into slivers. I needed little pieces to start fires in the cook stove and fireplace in the morning. The pine wood glittered in the lantern light like sugar or some yellow crystals. Some of the splinters was no bigger than matchsticks, and some was the size of knives and forks. I piled the kindling in a neat little heap beside the lantern. My eyes was wet, but it was not from sweat. There was tears running down my cheeks as I started splitting another piece of seasoned pine. "Julie?" somebody said in the wind, but the voice was close by. I kept hacking at the wood with the axe, though I couldn't see too well. "What are you doing?" the voice said. It was Rosie, who had come up behind me still wrapped in the blanket. "I'm getting in wood, since nobody else will do it," I said. "At 4 o'clock in the morning, you're splitting more wood?" Rosie said. "Somebody's got to keep the house warm for Papa," I said. "Papa is dead," Rosie said. "You might as well come back in." "I'll come in after a while," I said, and hit at the stick of pine again. In the lantern light, I seen my tears drip on the axe. Chapter 3. After Papa's death, things hadn't changed as much as you might think. For Papa had been sick a long time, and I was already doing most of the outdoor work, me and Lou, and sometimes Mama helped. You didn't get Rosie much out in the fields or woods. She was a house worker. When things had to be done in the fields or woods, Mama would complain, and then she would tell Lou and me to go do it. But it was up to me to see that things got done. In any house, somebody has to take the burden. Mama would say, "Julie, don't you think it's time to plant the taters?" And I'd say, "Mama, I done dropped the taters yesterday, and I'll plant corn today." She had never got over the death of my senior, and then Papa died, and it seemed to leave her wore out, like she didn't feel up to trying no more. Wasn't anything for me to do but take over and get out and do the work, whether I liked it or not. There was this Spanish oak that had fell in a storm the winter before on the bank of the road. It fell in the wind on the night Papa died, but I'd been too busy in the fields all summer to cut it up. So it laid there and dried out and seasoned a little, which made it easier to saw. The first time I saw Hank, I was too embarrassed to speak. But that was just because I was took by surprise, because it was the last thing I was expecting, to fall in love. It was late summer after Papa died in early spring, and Mama and me was sawing the Spanish oak right on the bank of the road where it comes up from Crab Creek. I reckon there's nothing awkwarder in the world than the sight of two women in long dresses at either end of a cross-cut saw. It was still hot, and my hair had come unpinned when I wiped the sweat off my forehead. My face was hot, and there was big rings of sweat under my armpits. I was so busy working I didn't hear the horse until it snorted and kind of cleared its throat. And when I looked up and brushed a strand out of my eyes, I saw this wagon hitched to a chestnut mare. The wagon stopped, and this man, really almost a boy, a big, strong boy, stood in the bed holding the reins. "Howdy," he hollered to Mama, not paying much attention to me. "How do?" Mama said, standing up. She had took to saying "how do" the way Papa used to. I can say without a doubt the man in the wagon was the handsomest I had ever seen. His hair was black, and he had this high, rounded forehead, and already he had a soft mustache that hung around the ends of his mouth. He was tanned dark from working in the fields all summer. But the thing that caught my notice first was his shoulders. He had the straightest, widest shoulders, and you could tell how powerful he was and how much he could lift. It was the way he was made, and not that he was such a terrible big man. "I'm looking for the Willards that are selling sweet taters," he said. "You ain't there yet," Mama said and pointed on up the road. figured I had a ways to go, the man said. Where are you coming from? Mama said. It was not what she would have said when Papa was alive. She said it the way Papa would have. All the way from Painter Mountain, the man said. I'm Hank Richards. I'm Delia Harmon, Mama said, and this is my daughter, Julie. Pleased to meet you, the man said and tipped his hat. That was when I felt myself get red in the face. The sweat run down my temples, and I felt myself blushing all over. Because it wasn't till that second that I remembered I didn't have any shoes on. I was saving my shoes for winter, and I didn't want to wear any heavy work shoes if I was just going to be standing in the leaves and sawing. And it was so much cooler to go barefoot. But at that instant, I knowed I didn't want Hank Richards to see me barefoot, like a little girl or a pauper. It was bad enough that he had seen me pulling a cross-cut saw. I wiped the hair off my forehead and tried not to look at him. And trying not to show I was moving, I worked my feet into the leaves. My dress was long, and I hoped the May apples on the bank would help hide my dirty feet. It was like I was caught naked, though there wasn't anything bare except my face and hands and feet. I was sorry to hear about your man, Hank said.
We have to believe the Lord knows what he's doing, Mama said.
Hard as it is, Hank said and shook his head. I could see he was talking like a grown-up man, which he wasn't used to doing. And he was talking to Mama for my benefit, or at least partly for my benefit. I seen he had stopped for my benefit, too, for he must have known perfectly well where the Willard place was. I was so pleased at the thought I must have blushed even more. But I seen that Hank wasn't going to speak to me. He was just going to talk to Mama so I could get a good look at him, and he could steal glances at me, and I could hear his talk. Mr. Harmon was a mighty fine man, he said, and shook his head to show he understood how hard it was to make sense of things that happen.
He worked as long as he could, Mama said.
He was a man you could count on, Hank said, and spit tobacco juice over the side of the wagon. The horse stepped sideways, and he hollered, "Whoa there!"
I'm pleased to meet you, Mama said.
I don't get up this way too much, Hank said.
You ought to come to church here sometime, Mama said. We're having a singing a week from Sunday.
Might do that, Hank said. I might just do that.
Come to church, and then come on home with us for Sunday dinner, Mama said. She said it just like Papa would have.
I'd admire to do that, Hank said, and looked right at me.
Do you like to sing? Mama said.
Better than I like to eat peaches, Hank said.
Come by some evening, and we'll raise a song around the fireplace, Mama said.
Hank lifted the reins and rippled them across the mare's back.
It was time for him to go on. He had stopped in the road and talked as long as was polite.
You all come see us, he said.
We don't never get as far as Painter Mountain, Mama said, unless we're going to Greenville.
You're welcome if you do, Hank said, and tipped his hat, first to Mama and then to me.
And as he did, he looked right at me, right into my eyes, and I felt a jolt go through me like lightning from the back of my neck to my groin, and my knees trembled. I was so thrilled I looked right back at him. I couldn't look away. Now a look can tell you more than hundreds of words, if it's the right look at the right time. A look can go through your face and eyes right inside.